This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulihi al-ameen wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Amma ba'd. So we're going to be describing briefly, because there's so many details, there's so many things leading up to the fall of Baghdad, but we're going to look at only some of the details. So we're going to look at the story kind of briefly, but there's a purpose behind it. Obviously, we're talking about when the Mongols or the Tatar invaded Baghdad and absolutely destroyed it. Before they destroyed Baghdad, they destroyed a lot of cities. So why are we talking about this? Like, why this topic? We already see the destruction of Gaza and Lebanon, and like we were talking about another time where there was destruction in the Muslim Ummah. And basically, I have more or less just one goal behind this, is for us to understand that the Ummah went through a lot of destruction. And it went through things that were arguably far worse than what the Ummah, not to downplay what's happening right now, but you will see as far as the death tolls, as far as the destruction, it was a lot worse. But it bounced back. And many people don't even know that this happened in Baghdad. Some people have an idea that the Mongols came and sacked Baghdad and destroyed the libraries, but many people don't even know that it happened. And if you went to Baghdad and walked around the streets and went to restaurants, and would you know that this place was completely demolished centuries ago? It was rebuilt. And in the same way, inshallah, the city of Gaza and the other cities in Palestine and in Lebanon, they're going to be rebuilt, bi-idhnillah azza wa jal. And we already know how that's going to end. So we know it's going to be rebuilt. But the idea is to get us to understand that the Ummah has been through a lot worse and survived a lot worse. And it's not necessary that every time there's a calamity happening or befalling the Ummah, that some kind of miracle comes and saves the Ummah. And as you'll see, after the Mongols entered Baghdad and they began to kill people for 40 nights or 40 days, there was a group of people who just said for sure the Mahdi is going to show up right now. Like, there's no way, like, a million people get killed and the Mahdi's not going to show up. They were certain that he's going to show up. And you kind of see this pattern a lot in the Ummah. You see it. You saw it when Bush invaded Baghdad, and the Shia newspapers and their social media, they were always talking about how the Mahdi is here. He's on his way. Someone saw him en route to Baghdad. Then tomorrow the Mahdi's on his way. He just had a flat tire. He'll be here any minute. Then tomorrow the Mahdi's here, he just got lost looking for directions. He's going to be here for sure. Why wouldn't he come and save people? And by the way, just as a side note here, for us, for the Sunni Muslims, the Mahdi is not someone that, I mean, he could be born now as a baby, but for the most part, we don't regard him as someone who's living in amongst us. You understand? We don't regard him as someone who's alive and living and well and everything. But for the Shia, he went into a tunnel 1,000 years ago when he was 5 years old, and he's just waiting there. So that makes him like less respectable, for lack of a better term, because he's just sitting there in this tunnel. Then it was a cave, basically. He's just sitting there. Type, people are dying, and he's alive and well. He's just sitting there. What's he doing? Is he training? Is he studying? What's he doing? He's just sitting there. A million people died, he's just sitting there. People get attacked left and right, just sitting there. But for us, because we don't have the belief that he is here right now and a grown man and aware of what's happening, that makes him a more respectable person, you know? And maybe it's a side note, but one of my mashayikh, he was one of my teachers, he said we prayed Isha in al-Madina. And then after the salah, I saw this red-headed guy turn towards the grave of the Prophet ﷺ and make dua. So he said, I approached him, I went to him, I found out he's Arab, but he's just got red hair. So I told him that, you know, in Islam, we only make dua to Allah Azza wa Jalla, and we don't call upon the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. And the Prophet ﷺ has already passed on to his Lord. So the man, he said, was shocked when I said that. He said, what are you talking about? The Prophet ﷺ is alive and well, and he just prayed Isha with us just now. Now, how do you argue with someone like this? You go down to their level. So the Sheikh said, he prayed Isha with us just now. He said, yes. He said, then why don't you make sure he led the salah? And you're telling me the Prophet ﷺ is with us, and he's somewhere in the ranks, yani? Name some imam is like stow. No, you stow, you get back. He should lead the salah. And he said, why don't we seek his counsel on all the problems and things that are befalling the ummah? Back then it was just Palestine and Kashmir, you know. Now I can add a whole list to it. Like, he's alive and well, and we don't go ask him, how do we solve this problem? So when you make someone alive and just not doing anything, you make him the most careless, like least caring person in the ummah. Same thing with Al-Khadr, yani the Prophet. Al-Khadr, yeah, he's alive and well. Where is he? He's in all the vegetable markets in Sudan. Always, in the newspaper, they always put every couple of years, Al-Khadr was spotted in the vegetable market. And he thought, for a while I was thinking, why is it the vegetable market? Then I realized how I'm not so clever. Al-Khadr, akhdar, green, vegetables. Of course he's going to hang out in the vegetable market. The meat market wouldn't make any sense. And what does he do? He just walks around vegetable markets. A great prophet who had so much wisdom that Musa alayhi salam learned from him, but he just walks around the vegetable markets. Does that make him great now? Doesn't help anyone with anything? Doesn't give ummah guidance? Anyways. So the point is for us to understand that the ummah has been through a lot and bounced back. You know, the Kaaba was destroyed by the Qaramita, and many people don't even know that it was destroyed. Then they stole the black stone and it was missing for years. And then it was returned just fragments. If you look at the Kaaba today, like 9 or 11 pieces of the, it's set in some kind of mold. But that's because they stole it and they broke it and destroyed it. But the Kaaba is still standing. Many people don't even know that this happened. They killed the Hujjaj and they threw their bodies into the well of Zamzam. And today we get Zamzam water. We don't even know this story happened. Because the ummah bounced back and it's as if it never happened. Okay, anyways. but the Mongols, they were... First, we start off... This is under the leadership of Genghis Khan. And by the time he decides to attack the Muslim Empire or the Abbasid dynasty in particular, his empire is all the way from Korea to Iran. Later on, it goes all the way to Hungary and Poland. And from Siberia all the way to the Indian Ocean. It's a vast empire. And it grew fast. And there were many things, many reasons behind why it grew so quickly. And he would conquer areas and he would make pacts with people. And being a nomadic group, they're nomads. So when they conquer all this wealth, they would give it to allies and to new partners. Because how much gold can you keep as a nomad? They didn't have much need for it. They didn't have like cities and buildings that they were in. So they would give it to the other folks. So their empire grew quickly. Anyways, but they were very, very vicious people. And one of the things that sometimes people try to shame Muslims and say, you know, your history has warfare and conquering and battles, and even the seerah of your Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam is just battle to battle to battle. Just open a seerah book, the Battle of Badr. And some books call it the period between Badr and Uhud, and it's like half a paragraph. Like nothing happened. After Badr, everyone's just bored, just sitting around. Then Uhud comes and everyone's excited again. And then after Uhud, just people waiting for the next battle. But of course, we got a couple of things. Number one, the seerah was written, initially the books of seerah were known as Kutub al-Maghazi, the books of battles. Okay, and one of the earliest was Maghazi, Urwa. This is Urwa ibn Zubayr ibn al-Awwam. So the son of a companion, and he was one of the earliest writers. The other early writer was Aban ibn Uthman ibn Affan, so the son of a companion. And his book known as Maghazi Urwa, where he just collected the narrations about the battles. So initially, it wasn't about the wives of the Prophet ﷺ and the children of the Prophet ﷺ. It was just a collection of battles. And then when it developed into the seerah, they started to add other things, the marriages of the Prophet ﷺ, things that happened between the battles. But they still maintain that structure of the battles being the highlights. And then the scholar said that when you write about someone's life, you write about the most major events. And one of the more major events in people's lives would be battles. Now, you're not going to talk about, he woke up and said, I'm hungry. What should I make? Should I make eggs? He decided on two eggs, sunny side up. That's not interesting. The battle is something major. So those are two reasons. The third thing is that even though there are battles in the life of the Prophet ﷺ, it is nothing for the believers to be ashamed of, because there has never been in history soldiers that have the conduct of Muslim soldiers. Never. We've never heard of them like pillaging and attacking and doing things and attacking civilians and stealing from people. We've never had that. I mean, I'm talking about the good old days. I don't speak for any of the armies today, but never had cases of that. If you remember in the Battle of Al-Qadisiyah, it was the Muslims, next day they're going to meet the army of Rustum, the Persian army. They're going to meet in the battlefield. But tonight, the Muslims are settled in a Persian village, and Rustum and his army, they're settled in another Persian village. And so the Muslims, of course, they're going to treat everyone well. No one's misbehaving. And the Persian soldiers went out and got drunk and attacked the women and went into people's homes and took their possessions. So some of the elders of the village came to Rustam and they complained to him of the behavior of his soldiers. And it is said that Rustam said to those around him, he said, you know, these Muslims, they deserve to be victorious over us, because they're camped at a village and that's not even their people. And look how well they're treating them. And we're camped with our own people and look what we're doing to them. So we never had that history. We never burnt crops or killed livestock for no reason or went into people's homes and took things. And so there's no reason for us to be ashamed of any part of our history, meaning the history of the Prophet ﷺ and the righteous Khulafa. Anyways, but because we had a code, if you remember Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu, when he sent the army out, he instructed them to not kill a woman or a child or to not cut any crops or burn any crops or trees, cut trees or kill any animal. They had a moral code, right? Whereas other soldiers, they're just trained to kill and they're just told you're a killing machine. And so when they go out to the battlefield, you expect atrocities from them. So the Mongols, they fall into the second category, where they don't have any moral code, they don't have any religion that guides them in this area. So they're very severe, and they would kill in the millions. They would kill in the millions. And those who didn't die, they wished they were dead. And it was so bad that people thought, Islam is done with. It's going to be, the light of Islam will be extinguished forever. City after city, region after region will be completely disintegrated amidst the violent attacks from the Mongols. So, this is the 7th century towards the end of the Abbasid dynasty, which is a very weak dynasty right now. And there are many other Muslim nations surrounding the Abbasid dynasty. We have the Khawarizm Empire, which is composed of Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Afghanistan. They're on the eastern side of the Abbasid dynasty. And there used to be long wars between the Abbasids and the Khwarizm Empire. And now Genghis Khan, forwarding a little bit, he dies, and then Hulaku, or Khan, he is the one now in charge of dealing with Muslim lands. So he doesn't want to just attack all the Muslims as one group. He wants to break them apart first, make pacts with certain groups, attack groups at different times first, and then when he's left with nothing but the Abbasids, he deals with them alone. Of course, divide and conquer, old tactic and everything. No. So but Genghis Khan takes over the Khwarizm Empire, and his armies will move from there. Now he's got the eastern side of the Abbasid dynasty. The ruler of the Khwarizm Empire, Muhammad ibn Khwarizm Shah, and There's a story where there's still some issue or debate about exactly what happened, where basically there were some either merchants, some Mongolian merchants that were in the Khwarizm Empire doing trade, or they were spies. Either way, Muhammad ibn Khwarizm Shah, he had them executed. So Genghis Khan sent him a messenger to ask him why he executed these two merchants. So what's his response? He kills the messengers. And you have this gigantic army and this gigantic empire and this man who's conquering left and right, and he sends you a messenger and you kill. When you kill the messenger, what does that mean? War. What's interesting is the Prophet ﷺ said in Sunan Abu Dawood, if I remember correctly, and Nabi ﷺ said, yeah, I believe it's Sunan Abu Dawood, the Prophet ﷺ said, "Utruku turka ma tarakukum." Leave the Turks alone so long as they leave you alone. Al-Turk is it's a large race of people. It's not just one group. It's not Turkish people. These are the Turkic people that include Turkish people, Mongolians, Uzbeks, Tajiks, Azeris. They're all under this group. They're known as a Turk. Just as an interesting note, some of the scholars said they were called a Turk because, I know I said this before, because when Dhul-Qarnayn came to the people and they complained of Ya'juj and Ma'juj, he closed them behind a barrier. So they're the same type of people. He closed them behind the barrier, and this group, Turiku, outside of the barrier. They were Turiku, they were left outside the barrier, so they became known as a Turk. Either way, the Prophet said, leave them alone as they leave you alone, as long as they leave you alone. And then also said, leave the Abyssinians alone so long as they leave you alone. This man, Muhammad ibn Khawarizm Shah, he doesn't even know this hadith. He's not well-versed, and he kills them. And so that's the green light now to attack him, and they enter, and they utterly destroy him. They utterly destroy his city and his soldiers. And they enter the city of Bukhara. This is in the year 617 after the Hijrah, the city of Imam al-Bukhari, and they killed the majority of its inhabitants. And when I say they killed its inhabitants, it means men, women, children, babies, old men, women. They don't care. And then they went into Samarkand and they completely destroyed the city as well, and Nisabur, and they completely destroyed it as well. And then his son, Jalaluddin ibn Khawarizm Shah, he tries to fight them, tries to gather an army and fight them, but he tried to fight them in an area that they had taken control of. They destroyed him, they entered that city, they killed everyone except for 400 handymen to leave them to, do their work, build and construct things for them. So Jalaluddin then rearranged his army and he fought them again, and he defeated them in Kabul, in Afghanistan. He defeated them in Kabul, but then he escapes to India and they capture him there and they kill him and they kill his children. Now, they enter the city of Harat and they killed hundreds of thousands. They enter another city, kill all its inhabitants. The city of Ray, they enter and completely destroy it. Ray is near Tehran. They killed its inhabitants. And all this within a few years. In the meantime, the Khalifa, the Abbasid Khalifa, and his name is very misleading. His name was An-Nasir li-Dinillah, the one given victory to the religion of Allah. What a name. He was very happy that the Khawarizm Empire is being destroyed, because he used to fight against them. They used to go to war before, and he hates them. And he's so pleased, he even used to assist the Tatar in destroying the Khawarizm Empire. Not knowing that soon it's going to be your turn. You think they're just going to thank you, send you edible arrangements, and just say thank you for your assistance. You're next. They're just weakening you. So on the eve of the Mongol invasion, there was corruption, disunity, materialism. It was rampant. The Abbasid Khalifa al-Nasir al-Din Allah, he was happy, like we said, to hear of the collapse of the Khwarizm Empire. And then in 624 after the Hijrah, Genghis Khan dies. And we already described the size of his kingdom at this point. And we said Hulagu Khan is now going to start to attack the Muslims, but he doesn't want to attack all the Muslims. Now, first, he starts to contact Muslims within Christian lands. And the first thing he promises them that if they assist him, he promises them Bayt al-Maqdis. And Salah ad-Din had just freed it not long ago, and he's telling them, I'll give back Bayt al-Maqdis to you guys. And they went to the Seljuk Turks, the kings of Armenia, and they tried to oppose him, but they had a series of weak governments, so they allowed him into their territory. So now he is surrounding the Abbasids from the west. He's got them from the east and from the west as well. And then he makes a pact with the Kurds. These are like the people of Salah ad-Din. As you know, he was a Kurd. He contacts them. He contacts Al-Ashraf Al-Ayyubi and Yusuf Al-Ayyubi. And he says, I will keep you upon your kingdoms. I'm not going to take your power away from you. I'll keep you upon your kingdoms. Either you help me or you stay out of my way. And of course, they agreed. Then he contacted the Shia inside of Iraq, which, as you know, it's predominantly Sunni. But he contacts the Shia and he gets them on his side. Al-Khalifa, al-Nasir al-Din Allah, he chose as his right-hand man, a man by the name of Mu'ayyid al-Din al-Alqami. Mu'ayyid al-Din al-Alqami was a Shi'i, and he was assisting the Mongols. He was on their side. Like, he would be helping them so they could come in and take over Baghdad, believing that he will be, you know, victorious and have a better position which they're victorious. So they agreed with him that he would decrease the morale, that he would let people know that it is impossible to withstand and to face the Tatar. And basically they spread things like, you know, what fierce warriors the Mongols are. Even their women are fierce warriors. Their horses eat roots, which means that the horses don't need nutrition even, and that they eat people. So all these things were destroying the morale and scaring everyone inside Baghdad. And Mu'ayyid al-Din al-Alqami, I'll get to this part in a second here, but now at this point, we have the son of the Khalifa, and his name is Al-Musta'asim Billah. Al-Musta'asim Billah. Al-Musta'asim Billah, Ibn Kathir, rahimahullah, mentions that he loved knowledge, and he was upon the Sunnah, and he loved scholars, and he was a generous person. But he was very weak in courage, in preparation, in ability, in organization, in unifying the ummah, in choosing the right people in his government. He was weak in all these areas. So he was good in his ibadah and everything, but lacking everywhere else. One of the interesting stories that's mentioned by Ibn Kathir, rahimahullah, he says that when I'm fast-forwarding a little bit, when the Mongols laid siege to Baghdad, and he's sitting there, and he has one of his servant girls dancing for him. The army's at the gates, and he's sitting here in his palace, and the girl's dancing for him. Then an arrow comes from the window and strikes this girl and kills her. And when he sees that, what does he order? He still doesn't order more soldiers or anything else. And he doesn't order anything. More soldiers, horsemen. He doesn't ask for any. He just basically beefs up security around the palace and asks them to put thicker curtains so nobody could see who's inside. Yani, they're outside and you hear girls dancing for you. Yani, fadiha. Anyways. So, what's insane is that they say that Baghdad, some reports say there were about 1 million, the population was 1 million in Baghdad. Some other reports say there are about 2 million in Baghdad. Either way, put it anywhere between 1 to 2 million, it's a huge number. The Mongol army outside of Baghdad is 200,000. 200,000 that are about to face 2 million or 1 million. Al-Musta'asim Billah, he could have mustered up from inside Baghdad 120,000 horsemen. And you know the horseman is more valuable in battle than the foot soldier. He could have gathered 120,000 horsemen from inside Baghdad, not counting the others he could have called upon from other parts. This is just inside his city, 120,000 horsemen. Not counting the foot soldiers in Baghdad, not counting the foot soldiers outside of Baghdad. He could have mustered up an insane army and been one of the greatest khulafa from the Abbasids. But instead, he's sitting here and the girl's dancing for him. And she gets shot, like, make the curtain thicker. Anyways. So, in the meantime, Hulaku also, he attacks the Ismailis, or the Ismaili Shia, or known as the Hashashin, the assassins. He also destroys them, and now he's getting ready, and he's laying siege to Baghdad to weaken them even further. The Khalifa sends two people to negotiate peace with Hulaku. He sends Mu'ayyid ad-Din Aybak, his right-hand man. Mu'ayyid ad-Din al-Alqami, his right-hand man. He sends him, the Shi'i guy, to negotiate with Hulaku. And he sends the Christian patriarch of Baghdad. Those are the two people that he sends to negotiate with Hulaku. And when they get there, Hulaku promises them that if he enters Baghdad, one, there will be no war. Two, the son of the Khalifa will marry Hulaku's daughter. Okay? That's like one of the great things. Three, that the Khalifa will remain and he will still be the ruler. And then four, that everyone will be safe. These are his promises. What are the conditions? The conditions are, first of all, and there were two people in the city that were asking for, they were calling for jihad. Mujahid ad-Din Aybak and Sulaiman Shah. Those two people, they were going around the city getting everyone riled up for jihad. So he said, what these two people are doing, this is not conducive to the peace that we want. So my conditions are, number one, everyone calling for a jihad, particularly those two people, you send them to me. The second thing, you will destroy all forts. You will destroy weapons. You will cover up all ditches, the ditches that are built, you know, for warfare, that are dug for warfare. You will cover them all up. And agree that the Khalifa rules under Tatar supervision. The Khalifa and all his family, and then the Khalifa and all his family members, his sons, the nobles, the ministers, all the big shots of the city will go out and welcome Hulaku back into the city. And when he gathered this group, it was about 700 people. 700 of scholars and ministers and the nobles and the wealthy of the city and his family members, they all went out to welcome Hulaku and bring him back into the city. But before we get to that, of course, the Khalifa agreed and he sent Mujahid ad-Din Aybak and Sulaiman Shah, and Hulaku killed them instantly, immediately. And he swore to them that he comes with freedom and justice and peace. And I know some of the story sounds so familiar, right? Like everything sounds extremely familiar. And despite all these ridiculous demands, the Khalifa al-Musta'sim Billah agrees. He doesn't fight. And he just agrees to all these things. And then they start, of course, we talked about how there's no way you can withstand these armies. They're powerful, they're this, they're that. So he goes out to him with 700 people and he kills them all. So he takes 17 in with the Khalifa, and all the rest, 600 plus, they're all killed, executed immediately. And then the Khalifa starts to realize, and you can imagine the sorrow and the regret, the remorse he feels at that point. Well, he knows this is it. He's going to be killed. Everyone that just came out with him was killed. All these promises were all lies. So he kills everyone immediately, and he just leaves the Khalifa alone to come back and to guide them to 5 centuries of gold, of Muslim wealth. And he personally led them into Baghdad. And, you know, the city of scholars, the city of Islamic civilization. This was like the center of knowledge. And it wasn't just Islamic knowledge. It was sciences. It was mathematics. It was the translated works of all other civilizations. This was an incredible place, like an incredible center of knowledge. And they enter and he shows them the gold. Now, there are two accounts of his killing. One of them is from Marco Polo, which many don't give much credit. Marco Polo says that they put him in his storage room with his gold, like his safe or treasury or whatever, treasure chest of gold, and they locked him in there until he died of starvation. But the other more accepted one, that has no Marco Polo in it, is that the Mongols had a belief that royal blood should not touch the ground. That if royal blood touches the ground, there will be earthquakes and calamities and all kinds of natural disasters. So they brought the Khalifa and they rolled him up in one of the large palace rugs. And then they had the horses trample him to death. And that's how he was killed. So what happens now? They enter the city of Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, the city of Shafi'i, Imam Abu Hanifa, the city where the armies of Khalid ibn al-Walid were there, and where Al-Mu'tasim, the Khalifa, would go out. He would go to Hajj from there, and he would go to Jihad once a year from there. And they enter. Now, some of the Muslim sources, they say that they killed 1,000,000. 1,000,000 is 1,000,000. So they killed 1,000,000 in 40 days. They stayed there for 40 days. And after 40 days, Hulaku says no more indiscriminate killing, no more. Why? Because the carcasses are everywhere and they're rotting. And it's the stench is filling the air, and he doesn't also want diseases and things and to spread in the city. So now everyone who is left alive, no more killing. These are the people who are going to bury everybody, clean up the city. So he left them only for that reason, not for any other reason. So for 40 days, they're killing people left and right. You know, they kill 1,000,000. And then there are like individual stories that are just so hard to fathom. Like there is a narration about one of the Tatar soldiers. He walked by this alleyway where there were 40 infant babies still alive on the streets. They were just recently born. And their mothers were obviously all killed, and these babies were just strewn on the street. So he does a double take, sees, oh, babies, and he goes in there and he starts to kill every one of them. Some say like with a rock, some say like he would just lean into his sword, killing the 40 babies. Like, what would possess a grown man to kill 40 infants like that? But this shows you how severe they were. And because they were so invincible, no one thought of resisting. Like, you would imagine, someone must have resisted, but nobody thought of resisting. That to the point that one Mongol soldier could bring 100 men. He said, I'm going to execute you. And he would start to execute them one by one. And I always wonder at the guy in position 63. Yeah, and you just wait for your turn. Like the first guy they killed, second, third, 23, 47, 52, and he's just moved. Can you just move this line? Hurry up already. And he's just taking a step forward, taking a step forward, taking a step forward. Then it's his turn. He puts his head down and just gets executed. 100, and it's one guy executing them. They narrated that a woman would just lead a group of men. She'd tell them, I'm going to execute you. And they'll just all follow her, and she'll execute them one by one. Woman. Five guys, six guys. It's hard to understand, right? It's hard to believe. That a Tatar soldier would tell a random Muslim in the street, wait here, I'm going to go find my sword. I'm going to get my sword and come kill you. And he'd go look for it, and he'd come back and the guy's waiting. Tabiakhi, just run into the desert. Just keep running. Ma mushkila, die of thirst. Just keep running. But that's how defeated they were. Those that remained alive, they hid inside graveyards, and they sit inside graves and inside ditches until after 40 days they said no more killing, and they asked them to come out and start to bury everyone and basically clean up the city. So they said that the Euphrates River, it turned red with the blood of all the victims. And then they said, the eyewitnesses said, it turned black because they entered into what is known as Dar al-Hikmah that had hundreds of thousands of books. You know, you'll hear that Imam al-Shafi'i rahimahullah wrote over 200 books, but today we'll have like six or just a small handful. What happened to all the rest? So many books, not just in Islamic studies and sciences and all kinds of things. They're all just taken from Dar al-Hikmah, this great library, hundreds of thousands of them, and they were thrown into the river. And of course, the ink was different back then, so the water would run through these pages, and it would dissolve the ink. And so on the other side, they said they created a bridge. So these books went all the way to the bottom of the river, to the bed, and came above the surface, that they could cross with their horses over these books. And the other side of the river, as the water ran through these books and their pages, was turned black. And all this knowledge was just lost like that. Then they had Mu'ayyiduddin al-Alqami, the Shi'i right-hand man of the Khalifa, he gave them the names of all the scholars and all the shuyukh and mashayikh that teach at the different masajid. And they went out and went through this list and brought them out one by one, and they executed them. When they executed the Khalifa, they executed him, they executed in front of him. They said, one of the things that we will execute you, but we'll execute your sons in front of you. So Ahmad and Abdul Rahman, they were killed right in front of him as he was watching. This was his punishment. So we said that Mu'ayyiduddin al-Alqami, the Shi'i right-hand man of the Khalifa, he gave them a list of all the scholars, imams, mashayikh in the city, and they went through this list, executing every single one of them. And there's some known and famous, or I guess somehow known scholars that were executed, but one of the interesting ones is Muhyiddin Yusuf. Muhyiddin Yusuf, rahimahullah, he was the son of Ibn al-Jawziyah. That's his son. They killed him, and they killed his sons, Abdullah and Abdurrahman and Abdul Karim. All of them were executed. They didn't even leave the families alone. So we said then, after 40 days, the killing stops, and they let the Muslims come out to bury the dead, not out of respect for the dead, but just so that we clean them up and get them out of the way. And they put, then Hulako and his army, they move out of the city, and they leave the Al-Alqami, Mu'ayyiduddin Al-Alqami, in charge, but they left people to watch over him. And he ends up being very humiliated, like he assisted them. When he was working for the Abbasids, he used to have a procession, kida. Soldiers and horses and carts and what have you. Like, he was a big deal when he came down the road. And now he is just, not even a pawn. He's just almost like a prisoner, but just not a prisoner of the Mongols. And he was walking with the soldiers, the Mongol soldiers, like a prisoner, not like they're his bodyguards. And one of the women saw him and she said, "Is this how you were at the time of the Abbasids? And you betrayed them, but you were like a king at the time of the Abbasids. And you assisted these people to come to power, and look at how you are now." So, from there you go into, this is just the fall of Baghdad, but some of the Muslim sources mention insane death tolls. They say in Nisabur it was about 1.7 million in Baghdad. Anywhere from 1 to 1.7 million in Samarkand, 950,000 were killed. In Maru, 700,000 were killed. In Aleppo, 50,000 dead. Taban, these are just estimates by the people. But city of Balkh completely destroyed. Haran completely. They would absolutely destroy cities. Like I said, sometimes just keep a few handymen with them. And of course, there was nobody to monitor, no one to report anything or videotape anything. So they just had free reign. They could do whatever they wanted. The point is that the destruction was severe, the Mongols were severe, and then things happen. The Battle of Ain Jalut, the Mamluks defeat them, the Mongols start to become Muslim. All kinds of things happened that changed, but the point is that they were not that powerful that they were going to make Islam disappear off the face of the earth. And every city they destroyed today is a city that is completely built up and completely populated. I mean, they bounced back. They bounced back. And the point was for us to realize that Gaza is going to bounce back bi-idhnillah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Inshallah, bi-idhnillah, it's going to bounce back. And with whether it's in our lifetime or not, we know what's going to happen there. We know the victory is coming for the believers. So our ummah has been through a lot, and it bounced back. And nobody should feel like this is the end, or we're doomed, and we're devastated. Sometimes you deal with an enemy that's so strong, you can't even imagine how they could be defeated. How could they be defeated? You just can't imagine it. The weaponry, this, that. But no, just like people in Baghdad, they couldn't imagine how the Mongols could be defeated. But they got defeated. So forget the how. You don't know the how. But you know that it's going to happen. And we also don't know when, but we know that it's going to happen. So there's, I mean, I'm not going to say like there's no reason to feel, no, there is a reason to feel saddened and everything, but you should never feel doomed. Never feel doomed. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَالْعَاقِبَةُ لِلْمُتَّقِينَ. And the final end is for those who have taqwa. وَالْعَاقِبَةُ لِلْتَّقْوَى. And the final end is for taqwa. So the end is always for the believers. But sometimes you go through a lot of difficulties, and Islam's gone through a lot of challenges. A lot of challenges. Like some were attacks, like the Mongols, like the Qaramita destroying the Kaaba. And some were just times in Muslim history where there was basically nothing left of Islam. Like it almost vanished. Whatever they were practicing didn't even like match or look like Islam whatsoever. Still bounced back. All these regions today, they have Sunnis and they have Muslims practicing their religion, and they have mashayikh and ulama and everything. So that was the whole point of the talk, that it's never the end. No one's ever going to be able to destroy Islam and the Muslims. It'll fade out by itself towards the end of time as Allah wills. But no one force is just going to come in and say, these people won't exist anymore. Wallahu ta'ala alam. Jazakum Allah khair for coming. Jazakum Allah khair for listening attentively. Sallallahu barak ala Muhammad. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.